in some instances you want to get the feedback, and in others you do not.
Okay.
You know, I think when I'm in my space here, I feel like, you know, I've broken 10,000 hour rule for, you know, a long, long time ago, that I have trust in that gut process of not only what it means to me emotionally, but how I feel like it'll connect with people outside the room from my informed experience.
Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Today's cool fact of the day is that isolated brains shrink. I don't mean isolated like operating in a bell jar, because that would be kind of gross, but fodder for science fiction. I mean social disconnection. A crew of 8 people lived and worked at a German research station for 14 months in the Antarctic. And except for a little bit of time during the summer when they had other scientists, they just had long darkness of a polar winter and social isolation. Apparently, the Wi-Fi signal there was weak as well. So persistently white polar landscape, temperature below 50 degrees, and you can't even be evacuated if bad things happen. Afterwards, researchers in Berlin looked at their brains with MRI and wanted to know before and after changes. And what they found was really interesting. So interesting that the New England Journal of Medicine published it, which is pretty much a very legitimate journal, even though some of the stuff they publish around statins is probably garbage. Sorry, guys. Time to revisit that. Anyway, the social isolation and monotonous environment is pretty much what we're going to experience when we go to space. So it's really important to know what's going on here. Good news, what happened is reversible. And their hippocampal volume, the hippocampus in the brain, shrunk by 7%, which is not a good thing. The good thing is the brain is plastic. You can grow it back. My hippocampal volume is 87th percentile for my age group. In other words, my brain isn't shrinking the way it normally does. Hippocampal volume is an early indicator whether you get senile cognitive dementia or Alzheimer's. So you want a big, fat, juicy hippocampus. Being alone in a featureless landscape in the dark is apparently bad for you. And if you live in Canada, I'm sorry. Sorry. I live in Canada too. That was just a joke about the winter darkness, seasonal disorder, et cetera, et cetera. Today's episode is a special live episode recorded in an actual proper studio. In fact, a more than proper studio, because I am at Steve Aoki's funhouse in the studio that he uses for his work. And Steve is the guest today. I almost feel like he doesn't need an introduction, but I know some people listening to the show pretty much spend all their time treating patients or in lab rooms or probably in social isolation, and this might be the one bright light of their day. So if you don't know who Steve Aoki is, he's one of today's most successful cross-genre artists with about, just 1.5 billion music streams on Spotify and a couple 2 billion on YouTube, and founder of a record label and events lifestyle company called Dim Mac. And he's launched the careers of global acts like The Kills, The Chainsmokers, and tons of others. Just a creative genius, a guy I've admired for a long time, and also a guy who's recognized by Forbes as one of the top 5 highest paid DJs of 2018 and the world's hardest working DJ. And they call him one of the most in-demand entertainers in the world. And he let me into his funhouse where I just jumped into a pit full of foam blocks. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for coming here, actually. Yeah.
It's super fun. We've been, I think, texting back and forth for like 3 years trying to find a day where we were both in the same city. And I still have yet to come to one of your performances, because every time I check, I'm like on an airplane going somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly.
So we finally made it work. Thank you for having me over here.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's so many things we could talk about on the interview, because you have a fashion label, you have this lifestyle thing that you do, and the ability to create your own music as well as to find other acts. You're a creative genius. I want to dig into your brain about why you're a creative genius. Do you know?
I wouldn't call myself a creative genius. I would definitely, I'm a grinder. So like I grind it out. I'll work 3 times as hard. Like when I think of creative genius, I think of, like, in my field, Calvin Harris,
mm-hmm.
Skrillex, artists that they, put their time and attention into one song or one project, and it literally influences culture. And they do it time and time again. They like always find a way to pioneer, and no matter what's happening, they'll do something different than everybody else, and everyone follows. Those to me are the creative geniuses in my field. But what I do is, that's not my strategy. My strategy is, since I don't feel like I'm there, I'm just going to do a lot. I'm going to do a lot of different songs, a lot of different ways to challenge my process, so that in time, I just get better and more fluid with my whole process, my approach on how I'm creating. And one of those might hit.
So for you, it's hard work and iteration, not creative genius.
Yeah. It's not a natural force. Like I would even say, when I got into music, I feel like when I get into anything that I'm passionate about, I'm generally a C-level talent. I'm dead serious. Okay. I really feel this way. Like, we're playing ping pong. I'm like the worst ping pong player out of my friend group. But I will take the lessons, and I will be playing ping pong over and over again. Yeah. With chess, all my chess friends that play, they always beat me. But I still like take the lessons. I get the passion.
Okay, you grind it out.
And when I'm in the studio, I just like shut the door. Here we are in the Neon Future Cave. And I just keep working, start pumping out whatever I can do. And I'm still, 42. I've done so many remixes, so many tracks, so many collabs. And yet I'm still doing the same amount of remixes, the same amount of tracks, same amount of collabs. Nothing's really stopping that same consistency of work, even as I have excelled or have like reached levels of success where you'd think like, well, slow down and then put out less. I'm still pumping out, the same, I don't want to say quantity over quality here, but the way my career has grown is from doing a lot and then sharpening. It's like sharpening your sword, like the more you use it, the more you just get better at it. And then one of those strikes is going to really shake the world up. And it's like some artists can get it on that one try. For me, it takes about maybe 10.
Okay. You write about some of this in your new book that is fascinating. It's called Blue, The Color of Noise. And I'm having a hard time believing what you just said. So if you were perfectly average at this, I mean, you're well-funded. Your dad created Benihana. So you might be able to afford a mistake or two more. But if 1 in 10 of the things you did actually hit at a certain point, people would maybe tune out a little bit. Your hair rate has to be better than that.
Yeah, I guess this is like what I say to myself. So it's a lot of mindset approach, because I guess you're right. If I did put out like 9 really horrible songs, or put out 9 things out of 10 that where people were like turned away from, then they wouldn't listen to that one. Right. So yeah. I guess you're right on that approach, but in my head, I keep myself grounded in that place, because I don't want to feel like, well, I only need to do this one thing and I'll be fine.
Yep.
I'm always kind of anxious that people just won't like it as much as me. I just have to love it myself, and then I'll put it out there. But okay. I know that in what you're saying is that the way that I love, and once I love what I'm doing and I'm able to put that out to the world, there is that level of like, okay, this is going to be something that's going to be important for the culture, because I just know to that point. Now, as far as how much it shakes up culture to, mm-hmm. The artists that, when we go back to the talented artists that just put out like the one record and boom, they like break, they break the mold. I've said this before. It's like, I don't ever think of myself as like the anomaly that does that, Otherwise, it's just like, like I might stop, my process, and I feel like it's working.
You mentioned something about a just knowing. in there. And I interviewed Rick Rubin and I've gotten to know him, and we've actually talked back and forth about it on the show, about that sense of just knowing and being sensitive to things, because I could kind of believe you, except you also just know, because we looked at where you go to design fashion, which is like, I think a floor above or below us. I get lost in this cool fun house. But you look at it and you just know what you want to do and you know when it's right. Where does just knowing live in your, is it a cognitive thing? Do you feel it in your gut? Like where does that live in your body?
It's definitely, it's an informed feeling.
Okay.
And it's also fleeting. It like, it comes and it goes. So, like for example, when I'm in the studio, if I'm working on a record, right? Mm-hmm. The melody is really important.
Okay.
Like I think it's easy to say, like naturally when you like listen to a song, like the melody is what's going to make you sing along or like make a hook out of something. There's a million melodies that you can make.
Yeah.
And actually it's like music is an interesting thing because like, you know, everyone's done the same melodies.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's been rehashed a million times. It's like wearing the same pair of pants. Like everyone's worn those pants. You just have to acid wash them differently or paint it differently. But people have already done that. It's just how you wear it, how you present it out to the world that makes it a little different. So for me, when I'm in here and I'm trying to come up with a melody that's going to, you know, that gets to that, the part of like, okay, that's the one. That's definitely the one out of the 60 melodies that we're trying to find, or I'm trying to write on the MIDI. This is the one. Now, for me, I can't think about what's outside the room.
So you get into the flow state when you do that.
Yeah. I can't think about what other people's opinions are. That's that fucks up your whole flow.
And when you talk about that though, you're always pointing to right in the middle of your chest. So you feel it like in your heart when the melody's right?
Yeah, it's definitely like the center.
Okay.
It's the center of my body.
So it's visceral.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Because it's an emotional thing, you know? I mean, when you boil music down, you boil a lot of this stuff down, like the creative process, it's a feelings process.
Okay.
It's an emotional process. So you get it, like you know it.
Yeah.
Like it's like it's there before you even realize it. Like once you hear it, once you know it, once you've played it 10 times, you're like, oh, this it's like part of your DNA. Like you know it that well. Mm-hmm. When I get there, then like it's a hit to me.
And you,
I'm ready to be able to develop the song enough to give it away to the people. So that's my process as far as getting to that place where I'm willing to stop the experimental stage.
The reason I'm asking is I go through a similar process as an author and a writer. You know when you've constructed a paragraph or a chapter, and I just feel like, oh, if I see an Olympic diver, there's no splash in the water. If I wrote my stuff right, it should go into someone's brain without a splash.
Yeah,
and, right. And I just somehow know in my gut or somewhere, and I don't know how to teach that, but I'm interested in how people who are creative and know how to spot it, how we do it, because it's a very unusual skill.
I think that the skill is that 10,000 hour rule.
Okay.
You know, like I've felt that when I first started, and like I listened back to those productions, and I just can't listen to them. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. It takes time to get there. I've like through all the different stages of my creative process since I was a kid. I always felt like I had that, but you know, you're living in your own head,
okay.
You know, or if you're in a band or if you're working with different groups of people, you're living in that space. And sometimes it's a good thing and sometimes it's a bad thing, you know?
Yeah.
Cause you're in that vacuum. You also need that kind of, you know, in some instances you want to get the feedback, in others you do not.
Okay.
You know, I think when I'm in my space here, I feel like, you know, I've broken the 10,000 hour rule for, you know, a long, long time ago, that I have trust in that gut process of what, you know, not only what it means to me emotionally, but how I feel like it'll connect with people outside the room. From my informed experience, by luckily I travel around the world, I get like the best you know, litmus test of playing in front of so many people, so many countries, so many different backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, and, you know, languages, you know, country, whatever it might be. And that ultimately helps, you know, my decisions without me even thinking about that, you know?
So the experience just gets baked in.
Oh yeah. It's right. Baked in without me even thinking about like, oh, the Italians are going to love this.
Okay.
The Brazilians are going to
love it. It's not cognitive. It's all like you're connecting in some other
way. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I guess if I want to break down the science of it, which is very interesting because just like walking with you through this house, talking to you about stuff, it makes me want to like really, you know, boil it out and see what the science is too.
I want to measure your brain and even have you compose something in your head and I will show you what your brain does. And I'm pretty sure I can predict some of your brain states that are unusual. Because what you find after looking at a bunch of different brains, I'm talking about the 40 years of Zen stuff,
you
end up realizing, you know what, there's a lot of people who aren't average and they might suck at some things, but they're super, super powered in some areas. And creative brains, you probably have a little bit more theta and there's some stuff going on. Yeah. And then, that's performance tunable. But we'll see if the hypothesis matches the data, and I'll tell you the hypothesis afterwards so we don't.
Well, I'm all about, for one, being self-aware and self-critical. That's a very important thing for just me as a human being. And two, when you are self-aware and self-critical, then you know that you have areas that you need that have inadequacies and you need help with, or you need that support, what like you're talking about. Like, okay, here we could advance this side of you. You know, So I always like go into everything with this noob mentality, like, hey guys, I don't know anything, but I want to learn, constantly learn. Even if I'm still in the studio for so many hours, I still like try to bring myself down to that student level and always, you know, listen first, think like hear a different experience, a different approach. And that's also another reason why I love collaborations, because the challenge to listen to the approach and process of other artists is essentially going to help, you know, get this gut, the center, the knowing part, just more rounded.
Do you ever have someone come into the studio? I'm not asking you to name names because that would obviously be bad. But someone who came into the studio who you just didn't gel with, and like, I can't work with this person. You know, something's wrong. Does that ever happen, or you find a way?
Okay, so whenever I get to that state, then you have to just be completely unmarried to like any of your things that your ego or whatever it is, that's like, that could be you that's making it hard. And I think a great producer can do that.
Got it.
I try to be as adaptable, like what Bruce Lee says, be like water, just be kind of flowing, like, you know. And, you know, it's also what's nice about this house is that this studio is our place to create, but this is a house where I'm being hospitable. So I care more about you being here and your feelings, and I want to make you feel special, you know? So if I can give that to you first, then you're going to be more willing to open up. And when you're an artist in here, especially if I don't know you, I want you to feel like you're comfortable.
So you're creating a safe space, and your whole decor is super cool, but it's also playful.
Yeah, it's fun, and like
you designed it to encourage that
pretension.
Okay,
and yeah, there are times like where it's like we're not going anywhere, and you know, we might come up with some ideas, and no real like progress is made. I have plenty of vocals from incredible, huge artists, like massive artists, that, you know, for one reason or another didn't like, you know, execute into a song. And it like, it breaks my heart, you know, because some of these artists have passed away too.
Yeah.
You know, and that breaks my heart. Like, wow, we made some beautiful music together. Well, it wasn't necessarily about the gelling issue, just because of one, you know, it could be a label thing, but
sure.
There's so much unfinished work that comes in the studio, whether it's from, you know, I'm kind of digressing here, but from like not gelling or from like other bureaucracy.
It's incomplete, and that's frustrating.
Yeah, but I always try to make it fun no matter what. And you know, I think the most important thing is like you gotta be the bigger person in the room if things aren't working, and just kind of take that self-critical approach, like, well, I can change it. you know, okay. or I can at least try, you know.
Why is blue the color of noise in your book? That's an unusual title to choose. How did you get that?
Yeah, well, first of all, blue is my favorite color. I mean, you kind of see like spots of it in my house, especially in the studio. It's also my last name, which means blue tree, Aoki.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Okay. And what's strange is that when I was finishing this book, I didn't actually put the two and two together. I was like, blue's always been my favorite color.
And you never...
I never really put the two and two together until like the last, I think I talk about it in the book in a way where I'm like, well, I'm that's the way it ties to the public. But for me, I didn't really, you know, it's kind of like that knowing thing, you know, like
yeah.
it's there, but you didn't realize how close it is to you.
Do you know how your family got that name?
Well, I mean, we're a family of samurais.
Okay.
So it's not a very masculine name, I think. It's not like we are the family of the blue tree, you know, fighting in honor for this piece of land.
The samurai were more about inner peace. You know, if they kill you, they're not going to kill you in anger. Cut you in half.
Right.
Like, I'm at peace with that, you know. But that was the, you know, the Bushido code was very much like that.
Yeah, right. But I actually don't know. It's like when you ask these questions, it makes me think like, well, I got to know these things. I want to learn, you know? Yeah. So that's an interesting history that I need to figure out, but,
okay.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. Yeah. And also blue, you know, when I started this memoir or when I was actually started finishing the memoir, I was coming up with a title. I wanted it to be about all the different colors that kind of shape the person that I am. The stories that are in the book. And it was just too cluttered that way.
Okay.
Like
I was rainbow.
Yeah. I was talking to, Neil Strauss.
I love Neil. He's a friend.
So I got on a call with him and I was like, I'm having trouble with some parts of my book and I need some insight, advice. I read all his books. So I'm like such a fan.
I want my writing to be at the level of his writing sometime. I'd help him name his podcast. That was my highlight.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. To Live and Die in LA. But
yeah, he gave me some like,
did he?
He, I mean, just in the, you know, the 20 or 30 minute call, like he gave me a lot of great insight. And I was like, he's like, maybe you do all the different pages, different colors. And I just kept on boiling it down from just our conversation. And I was like, well, it all points towards blue. So, and then that's when it was like, okay, I'm going to frame these stories as different shades of blue, how like they're different emotions of my life, different, like, you know, histories and times of my life. And the color of noise. Now, this is interesting because blue is a color that calms you.
Mm-hmm.
So quite the opposite of noise.
Yeah.
You know, it blue is in a state of where I go to reset.
Okay. So it's that inner peace thing again. All right.
Like I need that blue in my life because I live in noise.
Well, you look at, there's that and also blue tree. The trees are grounded. They have roots on the earth.
Yeah.
And also that's where you're going. All right.
Yeah. But so the way I see it is that it's like my world, my career, my life, my passions are like in this noise. I'm like in a loud environment.
Mm-hmm.
I make loud music. I'm in like very energetic places. But in order to be in that noise, I need to be in blue.
Wow.
So it's...
Well, let's talk about how you prepare for that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's exhausting to be in front of an audience. And it can also be energizing. At least it is for me. And I've talked to lots of people about that. For me, a large audience is, you know, 15,000 people at a Tony Robbins event. And you sort of get a little bit high from that. But the art of preparing, and if you're going to deliver for hours, you're bringing something of you and you're giving it to the group. How do you keep your energy up so that, especially after you fly all over the place, you know, time zone disruption, and do you have some sort of magic yoga pose or something you do before you go out?
Oh, like the rituals?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean... The rituals are like, it's not just like this like moment right before the show.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about bringing my lifestyle that I want on the road and treating the road like my home. That's a really important like just mindset that I need to have. That's not like, oh, I can't wait to be home. 3 more days and I'll be home. I'm like, when I'm on the road, I like change my whole way of living. Like, this is my home now. Mm-hmm. I am comfortable and I am at peace because I'm on the road. Like, I do 250 shows a year and I've done it for 15 years straight. So I've never not been off the road mm-hmm. for a huge part of my life, over a decade of my life.
Doesn't that wreck friendships and relationships?
I wouldn't say wreck. It just changes.
Okay.
Like, you adapt, you know, like, yes, I've like some of my friendships diminished to, you know, very few visits, but it's the sacrifice. Like, what do you want to do in your life? You know?
Okay.
So that's kind of like, for me, people that are in my life now understand this is like a passion, very critical passion of mine, and they understand that, and they kind of have to, because this is how I'm going to live, you know.
Okay.
If they don't get it, then like it just the relationship will, you know, in a negative way, will be wrecked. But
okay,
just, you know, it'll,
they have to accept you.
Yeah,
for you.
Exactly. Okay. So, but I think that in itself is really important. The mindset of first of all, taking the like, I'm away from my home, outside of my head, like take that out. And then I bring in like my workouts, my health regimen, meditation, whatever it might be, like that I would do at home.
Okay.
I like try to do my best to make sure I have it on the road. The hardest part is dealing with airports, is dealing with like waking up early and late nights, and waking up early, late nights, waking up early, you know, to go to the airport, mm-hmm. and the drudgery of like, you know, security, waiting for the flight and the whole ordeal.
They need to fix that. It doesn't even make sense. The airports, they can charge more rent. The longer you have to wait at the airport, the higher the rent they can charge to the restaurants and the merchants there.
Yeah.
They're incented to make us spend 2 hours waiting at the airport for a 1 hour flight.
I didn't think about that, but it makes total sense.
That's why it happens that way. Right. And I mean, I only travel about 150 days of the year. So yeah. I'm kind of a medium weight compared to 250. I figured I was spending 400 hours a year sitting in airports. And they're the least hospitable environments, echoey voices overhead and all. So do you use noise canceling headphones, baseball hat, sunglasses?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, same here.
Yeah. I got like my, that's definitely, I have a flying regimen too. I carry an obnoxious pillow with me. Nice. I carry the headphones.
Yeah.
I got a hoodie up if I have to. Mm-hmm. Put my hair up in a bun. Glasses, you know.
Yeah, I carry a little, it's a yoga kneeling mat, but it's one that raises the seat high enough for me because I'm just too tall for
those dumb
little seats. And I feel kind of bad. I'd like to have lighter, smaller luggage, but I can still carry it on, and you know, that's how it's going to be.
Yeah, so you got your obnoxious big old yoga thing. I got my obnoxious pillow. Yeah. We're very similar, I have to say.
Any
the eye mask
is
important.
Okay, eye mask.
Big fat eye mask, like cushy, soft, kind of pillowy eye mask.
Yeah.
That's important. Once people see you there, they don't bother you, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, I'm good. I'm like, I used to produce on the plane. I used to be like super efficient, but now it's not about like trying to cram it all in. It's more about just trying to sleep and, you know, kind of like entertain my brain with some movies and stuff like that.
But, yeah. There's a downtime value there, and you're really not. There's less air pressure, there's background noise, there's no oxygen, the air is crappy. So in terms of being at your height of creativity, it's an unlikely place.
Yeah.
Right.
But I was really like, I had the discipline to be like, I got to produce every day.
Wow.
You know, I got to make music every day. Because, you know, it's just that habits rule. You know, you do something for 2 weeks, it just gets ingrained in you. And like, it's not like this drudgery or this chore.
Okay, but so, something you like.
Yeah, so like I would challenge myself in certain places where I feel like uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
and I'd do it, you know, for a month. And you know, just like reading your book and like how you talk about yourself as this human guinea pig, like you have to see if your brain is gonna change in these environments, which it should, you know.
Yeah.
It's like plastic enough to do that. So but then it's just like, when you, after you get that done, you're like, we're like, this is just too much, you know, and then you have to like scale back, you know? So I guess it's like trial and error.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy, specifically more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy
so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Lilacue's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Lilacue has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Lilacue for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at lilacue.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
You write about being a vegan and straight edge and you know, your life. You've talked openly about alcohol and things like that. You're 42 now. Where have you ended up just from an overall nutritional perspective to be able to handle the lifestyle that you've chosen?
Well, so yeah, I talk about this too as like, you know, just like we're talking about how I think about my life on the road mm-hmm. as being home. I also think of myself as like an athlete.
Yeah, you are. Yeah. It's the same amount of work as being an athlete.
Right. And it's a wear and tear on your body, whether it's on, you know, I talk about this in the book, my vocal cord abuse, singing in a band, screaming in a band. I was in this hardcore band. So I destroyed my vocal cords and I would yell on the mic, everybody jump, or like whatever it might be. And soon I had to get the vocal cord surgery, cut the polypoid out. I had 1 month of silence, which was an amazing reset for me.
Wow.
I mean, it wasn't like going to a meditation camp or something, but I literally was like, okay, now we're going to start the school of Aoki. All the things I want to learn and digest. One was transcendental meditation. That was a big thing for me.
Do you have a daily meditation practice now?
I'm reading on this book about Bija meditation. I want to learn other meditation forms or styles or whatever. But
it's neat to have a palette of them to know the one that works best for you.
Yeah. TM's been like my consistent one, but I'm wide open. I want to learn more, you know.
I went to Tibet to learn meditation from the masters. Wow. That was when I first had yak butter tea. That was the genesis of Bulletproof Coffee. But I tried all these Art of Living, just wrote a foreword for the book about that. And that's out of India. But I couldn't, people say, what's the best one? I don't know. What's the best food? You know, they're different. Yeah. So I think you're doing the right thing. I'm always a little bit suspicious when someone says this is the only kind of meditation I'll ever do, because I get to look at people's brainwaves who only do one kind of meditation.
Right.
And I think we want to have a diet of broad types of meditation. Exactly. Just like if all you eat is Fruit Loops, you might not like what happens, even though they might be spiritual for you.
Right.
Now, let's talk about what you do in philanthropy, because we have some interest there around brains. What are your thoughts on philanthropy in general, and what are the areas you care about the most?
Yeah, so I have a foundation that the entire focus is on brain health, brain science, and working alongside scientists and researchers and orgs that deal with brain, the human brain, and actually as well as like anti-aging, longevity.
Well, you can't really talk about brain science without talking about aging.
Exactly, yeah.
They're so interlinked. Why that? I mean, you could have chosen to feed the planet, to bring water to Africa. There's all kinds of charities out there. Why brain health?
Because it's a huge passion of mine.
Okay.
For one, first of all, I'm obsessed with the idea of living indefinitely.
So that's we're like on the same team there.
Yeah. So like Neon Future, I have a whole album series called Neon Future, and outside of this, the org, the foundation, my whole approach on life, the Neon Future ideology, is the convergence of AI and us, our species, like this new
it's happening
new species that will form when we will merge with AI to the point where we'll be, you know, a more positive outlook than Yuval Harari's Homo Deus, you know?
Yeah.
So, I'm excited about that. I'm like crossing my fingers it'll be in our lifetime. And if it's not, I have my insurance policy to cryonically freeze my brain.
I was going
to
ask you that. So are you freezing just your head or your whole body?
I'm doing the whole body because I can afford to. I know it's not necessary, but because
how do you know it's not necessary?
I don't know. Like I was talking to Max from Alcor, who's like where I work with.
I like Max,
and he's like, I'm just freezing my head because at the end, like, I just want to upload it into another body. Anyways, I'm like, well, I'll just take the whole body, you know, even though I'll be a shriveled up old man.
There's a whole assumption there that consciousness is only in the brain, but it's an unproven assumption, and
right.
So my book, Headstrong, it's funny you mentioned Yuval's book, Homo Deus and Sapiens were both on the monthly science bestseller list, and Headstrong was sandwiched between them. Oh, so it was nice. Like the meat in the Yuval sandwich, which was a super big honor for me. And what I've found in writing that book and just processing all the information is that a huge amount of our subconscious stuff, it comes from the tissues in the body and it rolls up. And you're saying consciousness is just in the brain. The brain's a recipient of all these signals that it's processing and filtering. And I feel like, you know, you might stitch your head on a new body, but even with organ transplant things, there's a famous study from an organ transplant scientist who wouldn't write about this till he retired. And he said, look, I took the heart from a 22-year-old girl and I put it in an old cowboy. And his family calls me 6 weeks later and says he's taking bubble baths. Like what's up with this? This isn't, in his entire 60 years, he's never taken a bubble bath and would never do that. And so there's something in our tissues that's part of who we are. And I find it arrogant to say I'm only going to freeze my head because we don't know where consciousness lies. We don't know what it is.
Call the gut the second brain, right?
Yeah.
So yeah.
You preserve your gut if you're going to freeze yourself.
Yeah, I guess you're right. You know, like you never really know. So I am doing the whole body.
All right.
That's, I hope I live to this point where, you know, the conversation that people have is like, what? People used to die? You know, like, I think that'll happen, but like, I hope it's in our time, you know?
All right.
But going back to the foundation, it's exciting to also have this foundation just for me personally, so I can get into conversations with scientists
and researchers.
Yeah. You know, it's not just about like raising money, but raising awareness. And first of all, like informing me so then I can also be a mouthpiece and like inform, you know, whoever wants to listen to what I have to say. So I just love like meeting up with doctors and scientists and hearing breakthroughs and meeting up with you, Dave, and like hearing about what's going on with like breakthroughs happening. I know you're out here for the
American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine. Yeah.
You know, like when you said that, like my, like everything just like flickered. I'm like, oh, tell me more, you know, about the peptides and all like the stuff you're talking about.
There's several interviews that I picked up there for the show with, you know, people, most people have never heard of them, but they're doing this cutting edge work that everyone on the planet should have access to, that even people who can afford it don't have access to because they don't know about it. And by making it accessible so people hear about it, the cost just drops precipitously.
Yeah.
So if I do my job right, if you do your brain philanthropy right, the stuff that's the realm of science fiction or the billionaire realm suddenly becomes, you know what? I think I can send my mom to that and I might get another 10 years for her to get to know the grandkids and all
Absolutely.
That. That is unquestionably already happening and it's accelerating in our life. I've never been more excited about that.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. That's the first person I think about is when I hear anything about longevity is my mom. Like I've got to get my mom on that, you know, like we did the NAD last week. I was telling you, it's like, mom, you got to do the NAD, even though it's going to make you feel really weird.
I'm impressed that she did it. I've sent both my parents in to get their NAD as well. And there's a chapter in Superhuman about that. And right now, NAD is still reasonably expensive. I imagine that the cost should drop over time.
Absolutely. Well, yeah.
Yeah. And there's supplements you can take orally. I've talked about on the show. They give you a bump, but they don't give you that. I want 20-year-old NAD levels forever, but they'll probably keep your levels where they are.
Right.
So how do we do all that? And some of it's commercially motivated in that, you know, they're selling a supplement or going to a clinic. And I have a clinic that does that, full disclosure, et cetera. But what's much more interesting is who's going to fund the core science on this. And a lot of times it does come down to either government grants through NIH or it comes down to philanthropy. Because if one company is Upgrade Labs, this is a bulletproof spin-out, like the experience of biohacking, 2 clinics in LA, and I'm opening one up in Victoria. So we are not in a position to say fund an NAD study because it would take, you know, 20% of our annual revenue to do it.
Yeah.
And then it would benefit all of our competitors. And I'm working to move the biohacking industry up. So I don't really see it as competitors, but I do know that if I took that money and I opened a clinic in a place where people wanted it, I would help more people than if I funded the research, but I want the research and I'd be willing to contribute something to the research, but I can't pay for all of it.
Yeah. It's kind of thing that like when you bring that up, you could almost create this union of people where like, listen, we all put in this amount. We're all in the same business. It's going to, when the water rises, we all rise.
That's what it calls for. And across the entire supplement industry, even across some of the brain science. So there's this weird thing where, okay, if I spend $1 million in research, I would like to have the right to earn that back. That's what the patents and trademarks and all that stuff are for. But if it's a substance that can't be patented because it's already in your body, and you're not a drug company, there's this big gap. And so I'm hoping for anti-aging, some of the things like there's a Japanese root called Ashitaba, and it extends lifespan in rats by either 15 or 20%. Wow. That's pretty darn meaningful. And it's been used for thousands of years in Japan. It doesn't taste that good. I tried putting it in my Bulletproof coffee. I wouldn't want to spill coffee with that stuff. Yeah. So I just put it in a little cup with stuff.
Sounds like something you would put in tea.
Then, it wouldn't be a tea that you wanted to drink. Like, and you can do those mushroom coffee things. That's gross. Just take the mushrooms in a capsule or in a tincture and then drink your coffee.
So it's just kind of like you just put it in a pill and you just...
I think that's what I take the powder because that's a traditional way of drinking those. But it's more like a medicinal tea.
Yeah.
Like a Chinese tea where they boil the eye of newt and a piece of bark that you've never seen before and it smells horrible and you hold your nose and you drink it. It's more along that thing. But
I kind of like those. I like it when it's pungent, weird, and hot, and this old Chinese lady is giving it to me. I'm like, all right, I'm in. I don't even care if it's bad. I'll be like, it's, you know.
The first time I had that was in Chinatown in Victoria, and a prescription from this older guy, and he sends me in. It's something out of a movie, and you go in, and the guy who's there, he had to be in his 90s. And he had all these little wooden drawers just full of Harry Potter level stuff.
I love the visual.
Yeah. A piece of newspaper and he's this, and there's seed pods and all this crazy stuff. And he puts them in there and it was either a glass eye or something different because one eye was looking out over there. I mean, and he was truly a master of his craft and he had the prescription from the acupuncture guy. And I drank the stuff. I think it helped, but man, it was an experience boiling that for 20 minutes and
the smell.
Yeah, but you like that. All right.
Yeah, I do. I like the process. I like the whole visual of it too.
Yeah.
You need all of that. You can't just be like, hey man, here's a drink. Just drink it. You'd be like, then, you know, but if you get the whole process, the whole story, I'm like, I'll sip it down.
You're sort of earning it when you.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. You've got all the art, all the music out there you want. You have multiple companies. It takes a huge amount of time to write a book.
Yeah.
Why did you choose to write a book? How many hours did you spend on it anyway?
Six years from like when I first started writing, because I've written down tons and tons of different stories. And originally the first 3 years I was putting together the Dim Mach book. It wasn't about me. It was about my company.
Right.
Because the company's been around for over 23 years now.
Okay.
And it's just like we've dodged a lot of bullets that would have killed the, you know, where indie companies in the music business is really, really tough already. But we were able to like just dodge the bullets and go from genre to genre and influence culture the way we did. And then it was a lot about like the beginning for me. I was writing a lot about, but the beginning of why I even started a label and when I was a kid and like the story of, you know, a Japanese kid living in Newport Beach. You know, not, it's very difficult to make friends. It's very difficult to assimilate in the culture. You know,
40 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. And it was, I'm guessing Newport Beach was mostly sort of
96% white.
Oh, wow.
And as liberal as California is, it was like probably as conservative as like, Alabama. you know.
Wow.
Maybe not that bad, but no.
I grew up in Albuquerque in that same time frame. It's pretty darn conservative.
Yeah, it's very conservative and very just like there was just straight up racism. It wasn't like subliminal.
I had never met anyone from an Asian country until I was a teenager, because there was simply no one. Except at there's a Chinese food place. But like that was the extent of it where I lived. And now Albuquerque, you see Breaking Bad. I mean, it's very multicultural. There's Indian restaurants. There's all kinds of cool stuff. But yeah, I think a lot of people, especially if you're 20 years old, you can't imagine a world like that.
Yeah.
But it was very separate. So you were there. You're a Japanese kid. So people treated you differently there.
Yeah. But in the end, I mean, it's funny because I'll bring it back even further. So my mom moved to Newport Beach from Miami.
Okay.
So she moved in late 70s, early 80s. And I don't know why she picked Newport Beach. It's like almost like, okay, we're going to move to the other side of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And if she pinned the dot on the map just 10 miles away, she would have lived in a Japanese community with like 80% Japanese people.
Wow, but she didn't do the research. I guess it was harder.
I guess not.
There's no Google back there.
She's a woman that speaks broken English. Like she doesn't know how to assimilate herself into like a white, a Western culture or a white culture. So she just would go to her Japanese churches, meet with Japanese friends, but she'd have to drive far to do that. And so we grew up in Newport Beach and Irvine, which is the city I'm talking about, just like. Mm-hmm. Like all Asians.
Oh, totally.
It's just right around the corner. And, but for me growing up, it was a blessing in disguise in the end, because I didn't excel. I was, like I said, I would say talent wise, I'm a C level, person or individual. Mm-hmm. So I didn't excel in sports. I didn't excel in like all the traditional ways to make friends and socialize and like be accepted. So I just hung out with, I eventually met up with these kids that were also felt like they didn't get accepted. And we listened to the same kind of music. And the way that we got our cool points was by contributing to the little culture that we're part of. And by contributing is like, you have to pick up an instrument. You have to learn how to start a band. You have to do a zine that talks about this little culture. And then like all of a sudden I had my own zine. I was like Kinko's. I learned how to play guitar, bass, the singing. And I was like at practice all the time. And I was like, wow, this is like my way to contribute, to get like my level of respect. And now I don't need the respect from everybody else, because I found like this vehicle to, find my passion. And that eventually led me down the music path, which led me to start my label. And then fast forward, going back to like when I was writing this book, after 3 years of going, well, this isn't working for Dimmock. I don't know how we're going to sell this. And I'm realizing 60% of it is really about me. I'm just going to like put Dimmock into what would become my story. And then I just kept on writing with no intention of actually releasing the manuscripts or something like that. And it was just a ton of stories. And then I worked with different writers, different authors, to help me boil it down, to help me like color in, how are we going to put, like, what stories are we going to put in? How are we going to color these different moments, like dealing with my father's death, which was really hard to write about, dealing with my friends passing, DJ AM to Avicii, mm-hmm. to Chester Bennington from Linkin Park, talking about their influences on my life, the different career moments that excelled, really talking about failure and how to deal with failure. And then like putting it all together in this lens of blue, okay. which is the last step, So I had to like shave off tons and tons of stories.
So it sounds like it was kind of healing, or it helped you identify your process.
There's very therapeutic.
Okay.
Same time, the last 3 years, I was also, I had a therapist I talk with. So a lot of those sessions went into the book. So it was great for me. It was actually a double prong attack,
Did you have to pay your therapist a portion of royalties?
No, let's not tell him that though.
Steve, it's been a real pleasure and an honor to have you on Bulletproof Radio. And normally I close out the show by saying, how long do you think you're going to live? But you already talked about it. You're looking for immortality, and you and I are in agreement on that. I just say 180. That's at least 180.
Yeah, yeah. 180 is a good number.
I think it's achievable.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to ask you that, but I'm going to ask you something that is maybe more in line with Superhuman, my new book. And you have this vibe all over the place, cool robots and stuff. You get one superpower.
Are you talking about superpower?
Straight out of a comic book. You have a comic book, right?
Yeah. No, because I know who I'd want to be.
Yeah, who'd you want to be?
I mean, he's kind of like the cheat, though. Like, he's got everything.
Nothing wrong with cheating.
Green Lantern.
Green Lantern? I wouldn't have expected that.
Oh, dude, he is, whatever he imagines comes to life.
That's true.
It's amazing. I mean, imagine you can swim underwater because, like, some people be like, time travel. He can time travel. He can just imagine it. So it's kind of the cheat because you can do everything. Going to space.
It's like you ask the genie what I want, unlimited wishes.
And, yeah. It's okay. Like unlimited imagination is the only thing that stops him is fear. So if he's fearful of something, then his power's diminished.
So he pretty much has to be in a Zen master mode all the time or he can't manifest that. That's a pretty slick answer.
And actually, when you really boil it down, like, you know, I look at life like that where I can achieve anything as long as I work hard and I, you know, going back to what we're talking about, like, you know, finding that center, I can be able to approach all these different things that I do. And whether they're successful to other people is not what's important to me. It's just like whether it means something to me is what's important. And then I can actually go and execute on those things, whether it's music or fashion or having a pizza business and mainly based in LA or whatever it might be.
What's your pizza business? I don't know about that one.
Yeah, so I have a pizza company called Pizza Aoki.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. And I'll tell you the quick nut of the story is that we started in the summer of 2018.
Mm-hmm.
We have over 23 kitchens now.
Dang. I've had a restaurant in LA for 6 years, the Bulletproof Coffee Shop, and we've got two locations. I'm sort of feeling like I'm a little
slow. The different thing is the smoke and mirrors of what I'm saying here. We have 23 kitchens.
Oh, what does that mean?
They're mainly delivery.
Oh, so they're distributed. Yeah. That makes it a little bit easier. Okay.
So we started as a pizza delivery business.
Okay.
But because of the hype and like everyone's like it's doing so well, then we opened up two dine-ins.
Okay.
One in Studio City, one in Venice. Very small,
so
very manageable.
Probably neighbors because I'm in Santa Monica, around the edge of Venice. All right, I'll have to swing by. Do you have a gluten-free offering for me?
I think we're working on that, you know, but like it's fast casual, but people love it, you know, but
that's cool. I was not expecting you to say yes. I mean, gluten-free pizza, it's like, it's not really pizza then, is it? Awesome. Thanks again, Steve. Your new book is called Blue, The Color of Noise. And it's fascinating to read just to get inside your head and I appreciate your introspection.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
If you like today's episode, you know what to do. What I always ask you to do at the end of a show, pick up the book if it sounded interesting. You want to know about Steve's career, which is really in-depth and just what makes a world changer like him. Hey, he wrote it down for you over 6 years. You should read it. And if you read it, you also know because you always listen to the end of the show, right? I always say the same thing. Leave a review already. It's free and it's like leaving a tip for your favorite authors. Have a great day.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.